ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome back to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I am the great Ryan Last. It's my pleasure to be with you once again as the Tennessee Stud takes us down that road, down those mountains, the Smoky Mountains, talks all about wrestling history that he was all a part of. Before we get going any further, let's welcome him on right now, the man of the hour, the leader of the Studcast, the legendary Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller. Ron, how's it going today?
Oh man, I'm doing great, Brian, as always. Thank the good Lord. Feeling good and just ready to roll again. We're going to talk some television. We're going to go a little bit everywhere like we've been doing lately, and hopefully, fans are going to enjoy this one. We're going to cover a lot of ground as we have been lately.
We sure have been. And on that topic, we really want to thank everyone for the reaction to the recent shows. Of course, the reaction's always great, but we've recently just heard from so many new people who are discovering the Studcast. Thank you to all the new patrons, especially the people who have been supporting the show on tnstud.com. Thank you so much for really jumping on board the Studcast and supporting this show. And on that topic, of course, you can become a patron at patreon.com/studcast, or you can go directly to tnstud.com. And each month get the Super Studcast, and the latest one is up right now with Ron Garvin, former NWA champion Ron Garvin, an East Tennessee wrestling legend. Hear all about it. Hear all about his career. Hear about the Knoxville Five, and hear what happens when a member of the Knoxville Five talks one-on-one with the owner of Southeastern Championship Wrestling. Hear that today, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Ron, I know you've been really happy about the reaction to everything, but where are we going today?
Well, today we're going to begin on Friday, May 16th in 1975. And I get awakened very early in the morning by a policeman at my door who knocks on my door, and he's got a little bad news for me. We're going to discuss that bad news. And then we're going to get the results of the May 16th Knoxville card at Chilhowie Park. We're going to lay down a little foundation here for our format for the first ever WBIR Southeastern Television Wrestling Show, which is going to be on the following day, Saturday, May 17th. And that show is going to promote the first ever 7-match Chilhowie Park card that I ever have. So we're going to cover the 7-match card results and the comments. We're going to get comments from wrestlers and fans and the WBIR employees about what they thought about that first Southeastern show. And then we're going to take a look at who's coming to Knoxville in the summer of 1975. It's about time to change some talent. And we're going to get to digging back and finding out who stars are going to be coming in the summer of 75.
Ron, when a policeman shows up at your front door, do you right away accept that it's a policeman, or do you think there's a chance it could be one of the boys having some fun with you?
Well, no, I really thought it was a policeman, you know, and I think I'll just start right off of that. On March 23rd, I'm going to take you back a little bit before, in a way, I will answer the question in a little bit different way. Now, that incident took place on March 23rd, 1975, about 2 months prior to this time frame that we're talking about now. And that's where Danny Hodge went down to the ring and threatened poor old Dale to stomp this guy's face, the challenger, his $1,000 challenger opponent, that tried to stick his fingers in his eyes, and he tried to hit Dale with a punch. And Danny went nuts and goes down, and he threatens Dale, and he says, stomp his face. And Dale doesn't want to do it, but then Danny really takes it over the top and says, if you don't, I'm coming in there and stomp yours. And that was it. Dale said, okay, I'm going to stomp his face. And that's exactly what he did. And I had to give Danny Hodge a one-week notice because of it. And Dale Lewis leaves the territory 2 weeks later because he's fearful of a possible lawsuit from the guy whose face he stomped. So I'd almost forgotten the entire incident on that morning, Friday, May the 16th, you know, and when I'm awakened by the doc at the door and I greet him, the policeman's got a smile on his face. So, you know, I'm expecting him to say, you know, would you like to give a donation to the police department or something similar to that? You know, and so I smile back, you know, like he's smiling. Well, you know, and I figure, well, hell, he's a nice fella, you know, and I smile back at him. And then he says, what's your name? And I give him my name. And he hands me a big pile of papers, right? And then he asked me to sign a notification of service, you know. And then so I'm there, and I it's like I'm shocked. I'm like, wow, I'm not expecting this. So I signed the form it's proof that he has served me. And then as he turns to walk away, I say, hey, by the way, what is this all about? And he never even looks back. He just says, as he's walking away, he says, you're being sued. And I'm like, oh boy, what a morning. What a great start to my day. Right. So, and you know, this is the first for me being sued. I'd never been sued at this point in my life. And since I was changing TV stations the following morning and expecting my crowds to go down after that night, I really did feel like our crowds are going to drop a little bit, at least for the first couple of months due to the TV change. And this just made it a worse start for my day. I'm already thinking, you know, heck, I know I'm on a new TV, but I don't think we're going to have as big a crowds as what we have been. We're going to have to basically start over almost in a way. So I figured in an instant, an unpublicized TV change from one station to another was going to affect me financially. And it just made sense that that was going to be true. And the reason being, obviously, that most fans would have a hard time finding this new wrestling show. And they're not going to find the old wrestling show when they tuned in because, you know, it's not on there anymore. And it's going to take them a while to find the new show. And that's going to cost money. The television show each Saturday is obviously the best publicity I had to promote Southeastern wrestling. And I knew it. I was well aware of it. And like I said, it's just going to take time for those fans to find the new station because it's on another station. And I thought it might take as much as 6 weeks, maybe a little more. But I was going to find out the hard way that it's really going to take about twice as long as I thought for the crowds to even get back to the level where we had gotten to at that point. It's a little bit disconcerting to a young guy that's struggling to get things off the ground. And he makes a great change by changing his television station to a really powerful one. But it's not going to jump right up, and the business is not going to just double and triple right away. It's going to take time for this to happen. So, and it was really a good thing I was ignorant to that fact that, you know, my towns are going to be down. My town will be down a little bit for a while, or else I'd have probably fainted, maybe even died right then, because about that time I'm looking through those papers and I find out that I'm being sued, the amount I'm being sued for. And it was like $100,000. You know, this is 1975. It might as well have been 5 million, you know? I mean, like, it's like, oh my goodness gracious, look at this. So, you know, and I was really unfamiliar with being sued, first time ever for me. And I didn't have any understanding of the potentially long process of a lawsuit. I panicked. And I instantly fell into a state of depression. I was like, wow. I think I went right back to bed, as a matter of fact. It's like, oh my goodness gracious, what is this? So, and I had my little pity party for a couple hours, and then I realized I had matches to deal with that very night. You know, we're running a show tonight, and I'm doing the very first TV show ever on a brand new television station the following morning. So I really had no choice but to focus on my business in the next 24 hours, to ditch the pity party, and to begin to deal with the lawsuit after I got through the weekend. So for a 27-year-old man already with so much pressure from all sides, this next 24 hours during this time frame is really going to define me and my future, maybe for the rest of my life.
So this is the first time you're being sued. Who's the first person you call after you served with the papers?
My dad, you know, because I knew this was not a new experience for him. He'd been around a long time. You know, he'd seen it all, you know, and I'm like, Dad, you know, can I run this by you? And he very quietly listened, and he finally says, how much did they sue for? And I said, $100,000. And he said, doesn't make any difference. That was his answer. He said, it doesn't make any difference. You know, he goes, they may get nothing, you know. So it made me feel a little bit better about it. And he said, just relax, kid. You know, this will take some time. It's a process. And he kind of did get yourself a lawyer. And he started doing the walking me through the steps. So, you know, now where this has kind of risen its head again, this horrible incident in which Dale Lewis stomps this mark in the face. And, you know, it's going to take a while for this to all play itself out. And, you know, so I figured today, since I was served at this time frame, it's a good time to bring it up. And we'll be going back and taking a look at this quite a bit before we reach the finality of this lawsuit.
Mr. Fuller, we've been trying to locate your cohort, the professor. We can't seem to find him. Has he left town?
Yeah. I mean, you get all that. You get all that thing. Where's Danny Hodge? I mean, was he, what did he do? And was he not down there at the ring? And, you know what I mean? All of those things. You know, I'm started in a real bad direction here, but it is what it is. And now I've been served the papers. And so I just decide, you know, I got to go on with my life here, man. I can't let this rock my world. And, you know, I got business to take care of. So let's talk about that next 24 hours of my life, beginning with the card that night and the result of the action that night. Things in my life seem like they're going downhill fast that day. And the gloomy attitude I had was made even worse when it started to rain at the outside amphitheater about 7 o'clock that night. Like the lawsuit papers wasn't enough to ruin my day. Now I'm looking at rain and having potentially to move inside. Now the matches aren't scheduled to start until 8:30, but I had to make a difficult decision immediately whether to remain outside and risk losing the entire event in the rain if it didn't stop, or move inside into suffocating heat where there's no air conditioning and cut my potential crowd in half because the indoor building only seated about 2,000, just a little more than 2,000 people.
And the newspaper ad advertised wrestling under the stars.
Yes. I don't think, and we had been advertising if it's not raining and inside if it is. But I forgot, or someone forgot to put the inside if it is on that night's ad. So, you know, that really hurt me too, because some people are not even going to come because it's raining like crazy. They're not even going to take a chance. Well, they're outside. I'm not going to sit in the rain to watch it. It's not football. You know, and wrestling fans aren't used to that or accustomed to that. And, you know, back in 1975, there weren't any places you could go like nowadays to even get a weather forecast, you know, and they didn't have radar. You couldn't watch a screen on TV and see where the storms are. So there was no way I could figure out whether to run or not. I get no weather report. So the best I could do to make my decision was to drive up on the top of the hill above the amphitheater and look toward the west which I was on a pretty big hill, and I could see far into the west, and that's where the approaching storms come from, down south, and try to play weatherman. I go up there and it's raining and I see all this black clouds on the horizon I'm going to have to be the weatherman for myself. I'm going to have to decide, do we move inside or do we take a chance that this may stop about 8 or 8:30? So I knew that if I decided to move inside, it's going to take at least an hour just to move the ring and all those ringside chairs to the inside building. So as I sat there looking out at the black gloom, dark and incoming clouds and increasing rain, I had no more time to make a decision. I made the decision, let's move it inside. I didn't really have any choice.
So what time did you make that decision?
I made the decision probably about 7:30.
Okay.
Okay, between 7 and 7:30, and we started to make the move.
Now the show begins at 8:30. So you
the show begins at 8:30. I have an hour to get the ring moved from the outside venue to the inside building, and the ringside seats have to be moved in there as well. And the problem was it had rained a little bit, but we never put the mat on those rings in that outside venue until about 8 to 8:15 because of the situation that we're having that day. We didn't want the mat to be wet, nor the plywood below and the padding, stuff like that. So we had not, the mat was still dry, everything else. So we jerked the plywood off. So Mac, who was not just my head referee, but he was really in charge of setting up buildings and stuff. And the Friday night employees that he hired, they were there every week. They went to work along with me. I jumped right in there with them and took the help take the ring down and help moving the chairs. And we were already set up outside, and the ticket sellers were set up outside too. So we had to move the ticket sellers indoors, and we moved the ring and the chairs indoors. There were bleachers already in there. So that's where we're going to run. By 8 p.m., 30 minutes before bell time, just about everything was inside, maybe about 8:15 at the latest, and it was still raining. But just about 8:30, wouldn't you know it, the rain stops, right? So the building's full by 8 o'clock. And the fire marshal comes to the dressing room and says, we're full here. We're not going to sell any more tickets. I mean, so my crowd now, everything after 8 o'clock, the people that show up are not going to be able to get in because they're all turned away. It was at that moment, that I vowed to myself that I'm going to get into that Coliseum as soon as I possibly can to keep this from happening again. I lost thousands of dollars that night by making the wrong decision. I probably should have said, let's keep it outside. Don't put the mat on until 8:30. Made the wrong decision. It's not the last time that's going to happen to me. It's really difficult when you're dealing with the weather and you're in an outside venue. And it's going to happen to me several more times during that summer. And it's going to be a while before I get moved into the Coliseum, too.
Hey, Ron, let me ask you a couple of quick questions here. One, did you have a backup ring in East Tennessee? If something had happened to your ring that you had built, did you have a place you can go to get a backup ring? And also, as far as wrestling in those conditions, let's say it just drizzled throughout the entire show. Let's say it's a 5-match card. How much of that can you take? Can you take drizzle throughout a whole show, or is that too much water hitting the ring and too dangerous conditions for the wrestlers?
Well, God, man, I've wrestled in all kinds of horrible conditions. I've wrestled in San Juan when you could not see the crowd. I wrestled in Australia one time in which the crowd was only, it was in a grandstand of a racetrack, a horse racing track. And I couldn't see the fans, and I know they couldn't see the ring. It was raining so hard. It was up in the northern part of Australia where they have monsoons at a certain time of year, and we were up there in monsoon season, and it just rained for 2 days. We were there for 2 days and never stopped raining, and wrestled that night. But luckily, those grandstands had cover on them. But this amphitheater in the park has no roof of any kind on it over the fans anyway. And it's just impossible to run if you've got the type of rain we were having. The problem was, if it had just been a drizzle, I would have probably stayed. Then I would have had guys take towels out and dry off the ringside chairs, maybe wipe down the benches for all the general admission in the amphitheater part of the facility, and gone ahead and give it a shot. But it was raining so hard that if it had kept raining at the pace it was at 7 o'clock and 7:30 and up to around 8 o'clock, there's no way I could have kept people there, and they wouldn't have stayed. They wouldn't have come.
And if anything had happened to the ring, did you have access to a backup ring in East Tennessee?
Yes. Yeah, there were, you know, I mean, obviously I had another ring. I had a television ring. I had another ring that was on a ring truck that I used for spot shows. And I got a little smarter about this moving. And after that, I would leave up the big ring. I had a 20-foot ring that were in Knoxville, in the big in the inside building, as well as out there in the amphitheater. And that 20-foot ring, you know, I could have left up. And that's what I did from then on. I would just say, hey, if we had bad weather, I would say, Mac, put the ring truck up inside, and we wouldn't have to take the other one down and move it over and set it up inside. So we got a little smarter as time went on. This was my first experience with a rain out. I really didn't know how to handle it. I thought I did fairly well with it, but then once I saw the figure for the crowd and I had a general idea of how many probably got turned away, it made me a little bit sick. It was just like a fitting ending to the day that started out so sorry with the lawsuit at the beginning.
Did you say 20-foot ring?
Yeah, 20-foot square ring. Yeah, we had a 20-foot ring.
That seems pretty big for Tennessee wrestling.
That's a big ring. That's about as big as they made them. You know, most studio rings were 16-footers, short pipes, short posts, so that the ring did not sit up very high. It made great for television cameras to shoot. So we had a TV ring that was specifically for TV. We also had a spot show ring that was only 16 feet square. And obviously, sometimes you're in small buildings, you want to get as many people in there as you possibly can. But that 20-footer was our main ring, Knoxville Coliseum, wherever it might be. Every show in Knoxville, we tried to use that 20-foot ring. Makes a big difference in what your event looks like with that 20-foot ring.
Well, let's get to this event. Of course, May 16th, 1975, this show had to be moved from outside to inside. You wished you were still outside. What happened on this show, Ron?
Well, first match on that card was Tommy Wildfire Rich, and he beat a guy named Don Stanton. Dennis Condrey beat Tony Costello. Jerry Bryant won over Mike Duggan. Phil Hickerson beat Steve Kovac. And Ron and Don Bass beat Jimmy Golan and Jerry Jarrett with my help, while Les Thatcher was handcuffed to Sam Bass. This was a match in which Bass had been interfering, and Golan and Jarrett needed some help to keep Sam Bass out of it, and they got Thatcher to be handcuffed to Sam. And so Thatcher and Sam are handcuffed together, and Bass tries to win it for his team again. He tries to trip Jimmy Golan when the referee's not looking, and Thatcher stops him by nailing him basically in the back of the head. And so I'm up there watching from upstairs. We're in the building now. I can see everything. So I go down and I hit Thatcher from behind, and Sam Bass takes over on him, and the referee sees what's going on between the two of them, and he leaves the ring, which is my opportunity. I'm already down there, so what the hell? I might as well do what Sam couldn't do. So I go in and I knock Jarrett out, and then I get outside the ring, and when the referee rolls back into the ring, Ron Bass has got Jarrett covered, and he counts him out. So Ron and Don Wright, now they're watching in a different part of the building in their dressing room area, and they see me down there and what's going on, and they come down and they jump me. Now I'm back out on the floor, and they jump me from behind, because the main event is me in a handicap match against both of them. So the Basses roll out of the ring. They're victorious, and I roll into the ring, followed by the two Wrights, and the referee, I think it's probably Mac at this point, just went ahead and rung the bell. to begin the handicap match for me against the two of them. And meanwhile, the fight never stopped between the Bass boys and Golden and Jared and Sam Bass and Thatcher. And all six of them just continue fighting on the floor. Now, we're having a match in the ring, and there's a six-man tag that was over and supposed to have been gone, and they're still fighting out on the floor. So the referee's trying to focus on the handicap match, but the crowd's going crazy as these other six guys just, they don't stop. They fight all over the ring and within maybe 20, 30 feet of the ring, they go down the aisles and fight back to the ring. And so when finally Thatcher and Sam Bass, roll into the ring to continue the brawl, the referee calls for the bell, obviously. He disqualifies all three of us in the handicap match because, hell, things are out of control. Then the other four participants from the tag match come inside the ring again, and now there's eight of us fighting in the ring. It's like, and the fans are just loving it. They're going crazy. So a second referee comes down to the ring trying to help Mac to get control, and both of those referees get thrown out of the ring. So this brawl just continues on, and finally the heels, me and the Bass boys and Sam, We head for the dressing room. You know, that's enough of this. And the baby faces chase us up to the dressing room. And both of those matches we had recorded. And we're going to use them the next day on TV when we get to the new station at WBIR.
So the TV the next day will be building up the next Friday show in Knoxville. So before we talk about that very first show on BIR, Ron, why don't we talk about the card that you'll be building up coming out of this event for the next Friday night?
Good idea. I mean, it makes sense. I mean, you know, once you get to see the TV, then you get to looking at what the actual card is that TV is promoting. It just makes sense to do it that way. So coming off the wild finish from the night before, I decided to make the main event for the next Friday night an eight-man tag. Hell, we've had an eight-man tag on the 16th. You know, it went on for forever, it seemed like. So I was going to use everybody that was involved in it except for Thatcher. And he's going to be the commentator on the new show the following day. So I don't want to book him. I'm going to rarely book Thatcher in Knoxville again after he becomes the commentator, because I believe commentators should be impartial to the wrestlers, whether they're baby faces or heels. You know, I don't think they ought to be a Jim Hess type that, you know, lay, I love the baby faces, I hate the heels. And, you know, I think they should be impartial, and Les did a super job at that. So it would be me and all three of the Basses the following Friday night after this TV that we're about to talk about against the two Wright brothers, Jimmy Golden and Jerry Jarrett. And every one of us would work twice that next Friday. So I could get seven matches on that card for the first time in the history of Chilhowee Park, in the Southeastern's history of Chilhowee Park. I doubt that John Kazana ever had a seven-match card in Chilhowee Park. But I'm not sure of that, so I'm not going to say it was the very first time it was ever done, but this is seven matches coming on this card. The rest of the card for that next Friday night is going to be a Southern title match with me against a new star in Knoxville, Ricky Gibson. And he just moved there. And probably everyone recognized that last name. His brother, Robert Gibson, obviously is a member of the legendary Rock and Roll Express with Ricky Morton. And those two guys still work even today, which amazes me. Many wrestlers and promoters considered Ricky Gibson the better worker of the two brothers. And, you know, and Robert's a great worker, obviously, but Ricky was really, really good. Ron and Don Bass, with Sam Bass managing them again, is going to face Ron and Don Wright on that next Friday night for the Tennessee Tag Championship. Jarrett's going to wrestle in a single match that following Friday against Sam Bass. Jimmy Golden's going to wrestle against another newcomer that's moved into Knoxville. It's going to stay and work for me, George McCrary. And the Mongolian Stomper, managed by Bearcat Wright, is going to take on two opponents in one night, back-to-back, Jerry Bryant and Tommy Rich. So that's the card for the following Friday night.
Hey, Ron, let me ask you a question. When the guys work twice on the same card, do they expect to be paid twice? Is it something that in that day and age was kind of a given that if you're booked twice on the same show, it still counts as being paid for one show because that's what you were booked for? How does it work?
Well, it usually worked, and many times when I was young and in Florida, when they needed a substitute, when they had a substitute and they did not have a wrestler there, sometimes they would come around and say, who wants to work twice? And I was always the first guy with my hand in the air because I wanted as much experience as I could get. And normally it seemed like my pay was maybe half more than what I would have gotten. So, you upped your pay by 50% working twice. On this particular card that we're talking about, I probably paid the 8 guys that were in the ring twice that night more than they would have normally gotten. It all depends sometimes on the other people on the card. Obviously, you got first match, Mongolian Stomper. That's not the place for a stomper. He's not accustomed to being a first match guy. And you don't want to pay Mongolian Stomper a first match payoff, or you won't have the Mongolian Stomper very long. So, I had to take care of Stomper. It just depends. Then you look at your card and you decide how best to take care of it. But those guys would be expecting to make more, maybe not double what they would normally make, but they would expect to be paid more because they are working two different times. And I didn't do that very often. I wanted to do it on this particular card, I think, because it's going to be the first show off of the new TV. And because the TV is new, I really felt like I wanted to do something spectacular in the building or at Chihaui Park at the same time, just to show that we're trying to really change things around in a good way.
And we're going to talk about that new TV in just a moment, Ron. But first, a word about Super Studcast number 18 with former NWA World Champion, Hands of Stone, the one-man gang, Ron Glover.
Some Super Studcasts just fly higher than others. And number 18 with Hands of Stone, Ronnie Garvin, has reached a level not seen before at TNStud.com or Patreon.com/Studcast. This one has it all as Garvin and the Stud go head to head, discussing the controversial and fascinating attempt by the Knoxville Five to take control of Southeastern Wrestling, the Stud's company in 1979. Patrons love all 18 Super Studcasts, and ones like this are the reason that Super Studcast have become one of the most popular wrestling podcasts in the world. 3 hours of history from America's great storyteller or only $2.99 at TNStud.com or Patreon.com/Studcast. They just keep coming. Number 19 will be released on Tuesday, July 16th, and gets down and dirty with Dutch Mantel.
Studcast number 18 with Hands of Stone, Ronnie Garvin. Listen to it today, here for the very first time ever. A member of the Knoxville Five, sit down with the Tennessee Stud, the owner of Southeastern Wrestling, and talk about the events of 1979, the bloodiest wrestling war of all time. Hear it for the first time ever, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. And don't forget, the next Super Studcast, Super Studcast number 19, debuts on Tuesday, July 16th with Dutch Mantel. Hear what happens when the Tennessee Stud gets down and dirty with Dutch Mantel, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Ron, let's get back to what we were talking about. You're about to set up your very first TV on WBIR.
Yes, sir. And I arrived there at 9 o'clock, and we're not going to start recording to 11:30. And then they're going to play the program back at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So I wanted to have plenty of time with my director, Bill Kincaid, to explain how my TV format worked. The two of us went to the studio and we set up the giant logo projected on the main wall behind the fans in the ring, where camera one is going to be shooting, which is going to be the predominant camera for all of the production at that studio. And this is a big logo. It's our Southeastern logo, but it covers a 10 by 10 feet by 10 feet. It's really, really impressive. So as soon as we go back in the control room after we've set it up, I can get an idea of what it looks like, I was really blown away once I saw it on camera. So instantly, when fans got that shot, they're going to have no doubt about what wrestling show they're watching. And a lot of times back in the old days, the studios, they had nothing on their background walls. And this really, really, it just jumped out at them. So we then discussed, Kincaid and I, about where and when to place the bells and whistles that we'd created in pre-production in advance for this show and where we're going to put them. We set up the Vidafont that showed the entire Knoxville card for the next Friday, one match at a time. Les Thatcher is going to read this card off when he saw it on his monitor. And for the first time in television wrestling history, fans would be able to see the entire card themselves as it was being read to them. Next, we talked about use of the 10-second bumpers of the Greek statue that I owned and where they would be placed at the end of every segment before going to break or interview. Then we talked about the first ever personality profile, a 5-minute segment after the second match and break, and confirmed that the second studio was set up and ready for that. We were going to shoot these personality profiles, pre-record them in a separate studio with a separate background. We sat briefly with the production manager and confirmed with him that we're going to do an instant replay on all 4 matches. And we agreed to do a split screen on the first and the last match of the day. Everybody was pretty much organized. So Les Thatcher arrived about an hour after I did. We sat down and we went through the format as we would do every week for the next 4.5 years. Les and I were joined by the new ring announcer and co-host Phil Rainey when he arrived. I had a meeting with all the boys on the show about a half hour before the show started. I briefly explained what they were going to see on this show that had never been done before and told them that they should watch the show later at 2:00 when it was aired. I explained that so much of the show would be done in post-production after the show was finished, and the final product is going to look significantly different to them and better than what they would see live. So I wanted to fire them up, basically. I wanted to have great matches on this first show, but I also wanted to set the stage for the future when these guys all realized the huge difference between the show we did today versus the big Jim Hess TV WTVK show that had been the standard for Knoxville for many years.
Hey, Ron, let me ask you a couple of real quick questions. One, what was the conditions like for the wrestlers in the studio compared to the previous station in terms of, it's not a locker room per se, but the dressing room where they would get ready for the TV show? Was it nicer conditions?
No comparison. Just imagine the television station, this television station, Channel 10, that we're doing this show on, is at least 3 times larger than the other television station. And so is the studio. The main studio is twice the size of the TVK studio, but the TVK studio had no other studios. This station has a second studio that's half the size of the first, and then 2 more studios that they do news and weather out of. So this studio and this station has just got it rocking. I mean, and I'm going to really find that out as we progress with this TV that day.
And one more question for you, Ron, and I actually heard this from a friend of mine, Professor Ricardo Coleman. He wanted to know, was it Bill Kincaid that was responsible for the funky music you had on the show, whether it was during the animation or during some of the bumpers? Who was responsible for the music? Was it Bill Kincaid?
Yes. Actually, I kind of turned Bill Kincaid loose because once I realized how sharp he was, and how efficient he was, that, you know, he could find better music. He was a young guy. He really had it all going. And I felt real comfortable to just say, Bill, just find the music yourself, cut the music, get that stuff done yourself. So basically I sat in the control room, right beside Bill Kincaid, when the show began. And I'm going to sit in that spot for as long as Southeastern Wrestling exists. It made a fantastic difference, I think, in the results of every one of those television shows because I knew what was going to happen in the matches, and I could guide the director in advance to get the best camera angle possible. I knew what was coming up. I never told him I knew, but I didn't need to, because he was so darn efficient at his job that he could make the, he was picking the right camera shots even without my saying something to him. You know, I was like, wow, this kid is so good. I was so proud as I watched that first show opening with those logo characters moving through it, and followed instantly by the first shot of that fantastic set behind Les and Phil Rainey. And my attitude would just improve with every new thing that popped up that morning. I finally realized we were really off and running with a great television product. The first of four wrestling segments that day opened with the very impressive Mongolian Stomper and his manager, Bearcat Wright, versus the Job Boy, who I felt very sorry for after watching the match. I mean, Stomper took no pity. He never took pity on guys, you know, and wow, I mean, he stomped this guy's brains out. It was terrible. Bearcat made the interview. They went to the desk, and they made the first interview ever on the Southeastern Wrestling program after the commercial break. And Bearcat was a great talker, and he focused on his monster beating two guys in the same night next Friday, that he's so good that you can't put him with just one guy. He needs to have two. In fact, you know, I mean, I think Bearcat said he could beat four. If we wanted to have four guys, he'd beat four guys. So fans were pretty much in awe and scared of the Stomper, to the extent that they had run screaming through the building as he charged into the crowd, his first appearance at that third Coliseum show. That was the first time he'd come back after the Coliseum show was for this TV. And when he charged into the crowd at the Coliseum, oh, it was pandemonium there. So it was only my second experience working with Archie Goldie, the Stomper. I loved the Stomper. I grew to love the Stomper. He was just a magnificent talent. But he was presently working at that time for Jared on the other side of the state. But I made a promise to myself right then that, you know, if my business ever took off, that there's the first guy right there that I want to bring in here and keep here is the Mongolian Stomper. So second wrestling segment, the tag match with Ron and Don Wright getting a strong win before their Tennessee Tag Championship match the following Friday against the Bass Boys. They went to the desk afterward with Jimmy Golden to watch the wild back-to-back matches from the night before that I described earlier in this episode, where pandemonium had ensued. Golden talked about how it cost him and Jerry to win against the Bass Boys. The Wrights really got the crowd up talking about their chance to win the Tennessee Tag titles next Friday. And then the three of them focused on the eight-man tag main event. The show was off to a great start, but there was so much left to come in that first show for Southeastern. Next up was a weekly segment called Personality Profile that was totally different than anything that had ever been done before on any wrestling show. 5 minutes long and all about individual or tag teams, hobbies, or interests that didn't necessarily pertain to wrestling. That was so much different than what everybody was doing. These segments were pre-recorded in, like I said earlier, an adjoining studio with its own set. The first one was going to be me, because I was going to wrestle on TV that day for the very first time and defend my Southern title. I was dressed in a suit, and I had my belt over my shoulder as I sat there in a chair, Les and I, with a real nice background and backdrop. And Les and I talked about, first of all, my family's history, my basketball background, and then we got into a little bit of wrestling at the end of why was I wrestling on TV for the first time. And I said it was because I had chosen because I had been chosen by this station to be the pitch man for Southeastern Wrestling on all these promos that fans were now seeing on this station. They'd been running those promos for a week. So I said, hey, I'm here. And I'm going to wrestle because I owe it to this station. Basically, they've made me the pitch man, you know. And this station, then I continued, you know, I said, this station is one of the strongest and best in America and deserves the best wrestler in America to be on the air with them. So during my time in their studios, I said, producing those promos fans are seeing, I realized the new wrestling show is going to be better than any wrestling show I had ever seen. And that includes shows from all over the world where I had wrestled, Australia, Japan, other places. Today, I said, is a historic day for fans in five states that have the opportunity to see the greatest wrestling show and the greatest Southern champion of all time. When the personality profile was over and shown later, the fans booed me like crazy when I was introduced in the ring because it's the next segment that I'm on. Now I'm dressed and ready to defend my belt. And it just went out of that profile directly into the ring with me ready to go. And the fans, they got to see that on their monitors. So they were responding. It was a great introduction.
Well, hold on, Ron. Before we get there, I just want to point this out because you mentioned it way back when you first started the show. You don't wrestle on TV, so you haven't wrestled on TV once in the entire time, other than clips from the arena show. You haven't wrestled on TV once in the studio the entire time you've owned Southeastern.
That's right. That's correct. I have yet to wrestle on TV. I've been here 7 months. And that's what I said on the profile about why I was wrestling on TV, the way I answered less, but there's really more to it. You know, I really felt like it was time for me to wrestle on TV because, first of all, it's going to emphasize the importance of this new wrestling show. By me wrestling, had never wrestled on television there. And the first time I do, it's for a new television station and a new television show. I just felt like that's a great way to get it started. And because I no longer had a valet as I had when I arrived in Knoxville, and I really needed wins on TV to keep building my heat. It's pretty hard not to get those really good wins right there on television and just to show the film of what you did in a town somewhere else. You can't overemphasize the wins on television for getting guys over. So by wrestling on TV, I could help ratings significantly in the future by actually being in the ring as well as just interviewing on each program.
So what happened here on this show, your first match on TV? Who'd you go against?
This first match, I was defending my title against Tommy Wildfire Rich. And we went about 15 minutes. Tommy's a really young guy. I'm fairly young still, obviously, at this point. But Tommy's very green. But he's a great worker. And we go about 15 minutes. We do a lot of wrestling. And I beat him with my Fuller leg lock. And Ricky Gibson is going to be wrestling me the next Friday night. Early in the card for my Southern title. So I had him sit in with Les to do the commentary over my match, which that's always a great thing to do. It's a real great way to emphasize who you're wrestling and to put guys over. And it makes for a better segment. He did a great job of putting me over too and highlighting the new show as well. Made some really nice comments about, wow, I've never seen that before, Les, and never seen that. So then he made another great babyface move on the end because once I put the toehold on Tommy Rich, I didn't want him to get up and get out of the ring too quickly. So Ricky goes into the ring and helps Tommy get back to the dressing room, which really helped to sell my dang Fuller leg lock. So that's the last segment in this television show is an unusual six-man tag with all three of the Basses versus this really great team of Rocky Smith, Devoy Brunson, and Rick Connors. I went to the ring with the Basses because we're in that eight-man tag together as a team on the following Friday night. So I wanted to have them see all four of us at the same time on the actual television program. And when they got in trouble during the Babyface's comeback, Ron Bass shot old Connors out of the ring, and I put the Fuller leg lock on him on the floor. And I'm not involved in the match, but, you know, he started to get up, and he's bent over, and he's perfect for me. I grapevined him, and here we went. I dropped him on the concrete and finished him off with a leg hold. So the Basses, now they're three in there against two, and they obviously get the win. And it got a lot of heat, you know. And Smith and Brunson has to carry Connors out of the studio. It's the second guy I put my toehold on in the same day, and both of them had to be carried out. That's the kind of the reason I'm talking about wrestling on TV. That makes a huge, huge difference when you can actually do something live right there on television.
Ron, what was the reaction like to this first show you did on WBIR?
We finished the show about 12:30 in the afternoon. And I had no breakfast before arriving at the station, and I'd done a significant amount of preparation for this first show in the 2.5 hours before it began. I also done the personality profile. I wrestled my first TV match ever on this program. I got involved in the last match of the show. And after taping the show, I stopped and I grabbed myself a quick meal before getting home because I wanted to be there at 2 o'clock and see this show myself. I thought I had a good idea what the show was going to look like while watching it being recorded. I was wrong. After they inserted all those bells and whistles in the post-production, the show was absolutely phenomenal. The great opening, the beautiful set, the two very professional commentators that weren't trying to be the stars of the show for a change, 9 very well-trained TV employees trying their best to do their best, awesome Greek statue bumpers, one-of-a-kind personality profile, vitafonted cards, guaranteed great results, 4 great matches, 4 groundbreaking instant replays, 1 for every match, 2 split screens that had never been done before ever, and a close for the show with slow motion finishes of the matches on the show and credits rolling over the top of them. It all combined to make the new show better than I ever imagined it would be.
What do you think Big Jim Hess thought sitting on his couch at home tuned into WBIR?
I doubt he watched. You know, in fact, I'm pretty sure he wouldn't have watched that show. And if he did, he must have pinched himself several times, wishing that he was sitting there and being able to do something on that show. So, I can't imagine he watched it, first of all. I think, when I walked away from him and never gave him a chance, never had any, let him reply to me once I fired him. I'm sure he never wanted to see me again. So, but I did get calls from a lot of people that did see it. My first call came about 2 minutes after the show ended, and it was from Les Thatcher. And boy, he was so excited, I could hardly understand what he was saying. And we talked probably for about 15 minutes, and we were feeding off of each other's observations and discussing what we could do to improve the show. And that wasn't a very long conversation because the show was darn near perfect. But I could tell he couldn't even hide the excitement in his voice. We both couldn't wait for the next Saturday to see if it was all just a dream, what we had gone through that day, and if it was as good as we really thought it was. Next call I got was from Mac. And he was kind of like same as Les. I mean, just really on cloud 9. And he was a Florida boy all his life. And he compared it right away to the Florida Championship Wrestling Show with Gordon Solie. But then he added, he said something like, but Ron, it was much better than the Tampa show. It had so many little things that he had never seen before in any wrestling show. Then the boys started calling, the wrestlers. Never had that happen before or since. Wrestler after wrestler. They all thought it was by far the best studio show they'd ever seen. I'd never heard a single wrestler ever say anything about the production of a wrestling show before. But on that Saturday, I heard comments from wrestlers about the little things that we had created and the impact that made on the quality of the entire show. I thought most wrestlers didn't pay any attention to anything except their own TV match. But after hearing that so many great comments, I realized how invested all the wrestlers who called were in the television shows they worked and just how much they appreciated an owner that was determined to make his show something special. Again, as with Les Thatcher and Mac's conversation, the excitement in their voices told the entire story. We were definitely on to something, but I wanted to hear it from the real experts, the television employees and management themselves at WBIR.
Did you hear it from them?
I certainly did. I had to wait till Monday. I would have gone on Sunday if I thought they were going to be there. But I showed up early Monday morning, and the first place I went was to the GM. And obviously, they set me outside for a few minutes, but he didn't keep me waiting but a couple of minutes. And I knew when I entered his office that he had watched the show. He had this huge smile on his face, and he got up out of his chair, and he came straight to me. And he hugged me like my dad always did. I mean, it was like a fatherly hug. And he didn't even give me a chance to say anything before he lit my day up, man. The first thing out of his mouth was, it has to be the best wrestling show in the world. And I think that was the first time anyone ever said that to me and spoke in those terms about the show. And luckily, I'm going to hear that many, many times over the coming years about it being the best wrestling show in the world. But it came out of that GM's mouth first. And then I made a tour of the station. I went from the management departments, from production to sales. And it became apparent that they had all watched the show. That was shocking to me. I don't know if the GM passed around a message requiring them to watch it, or if they just were so invested in their station's programming, they watched all the station's new shows debuts. But they could not all have been wrestling fans. I got the feeling that this station was probably very different than most in the country. It seemed all their employees wanted every show they aired to not only be successful, but be the best. Their comments were all positive, and obviously it made me so happy to be working with people like that after the station that I just left. My final stop is with the new director, Bill Kincaid. He's my walk-on-water guy. That's what I call him. He asked me the big question before I could even ask his opinion. He asked me, what did you think about it? Well, by now, everybody listening here knows my answer to that and pretty much everybody else's answer. So I asked him the same question. I said, what did you think about it? And he thrilled me with his answer. He said, Ron, it was my first show. I definitely think I can do better. You know, and Brian, my first thought was, even long before the song was ever written, the future's so bright, I need to wear shades, man. It was like, wow, I was really, really on fire.
Well, Ron, we are really running tight on time, and I know there's still so much to talk about. We'll pick it up next week. We'll hear all about the show you ran on May 23rd, 1975 in Knoxville, and more about the reaction to this very first television show on WBIR for Southeastern Championship Wrestling. We want to remind all the listeners, you can become friends with the Tennessee Stud on Facebook. His page, Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. You could follow the Stud on Instagram and Twitter at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last, and you can hear me on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com or available wherever it is that you find your favorite podcast for classic wrestling talk and wrestling humor. And we also want to remind you, you can follow the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network on Twitter, the page at Super Podcasts. Of course, we mentioned it earlier. You heard the break. Super Studcast number 18, breaking all sorts of records. The most popular Super Studcast to date, but they keep getting more and more popular each and every time we put one out. But hear all about the 1979 Knoxville Wrestling War. Hear all about the career of Ronnie Garvin, a career that led him to the NWA World Heavyweight Championship. Check that out today, and be sure and check out the next Super Studcast, number 19, with Dutch Mantell. The Studcast is going to get down and dirty, debuting on July 16th, but you can hear Super Studcast number 18, parts 1 and 2 today, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Ron, on the topic of the Studcast, where are we going next week?
Well, we're going to, since we've left here, we're going to go back and cover this card, this big 7-match card in Chihuahua Park outside in the amphitheater. We're not going to get rain this time. It's going to be a tremendous night of wrestling for fans there. We're going to talk about the $1,000 challenger lawsuit. We're going to probably be talking about that for a little while here. We're going to cross the state to Memphis, and I'm going to be wrestling the third time for the NWA world title against Jack Briscoe in Memphis in 8 weeks. Never seen that happen before in any city ever. Going to draw another 10,000 plus fans. Big, great event there. We're going to cover early June in 1975 in Knoxville, and we're going to begin to take a rare look into my personal life that's going to dramatically affect my future in Knoxville.
Ron Fuller's Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller, I'm the Great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.